We'd Like a Word.
Welcome back to this episode of We'd Like a Word on writing dynasties and big authorial brands. With me, Paul Waters.
And me, Stephen Colgan.
And with us, we have Felix Francis, son of Dick Francis. And we have Andrew Grant, brother of Lee Child. Andrew also being known as Andrew Child now, and who's collaborator with Lee on the Jack Reacher books. And we will at some point in this part hear from Rajmohan Gandhi. But maybe we should hear from Felix Francis first and read a bit of that lovely book you have in your hand. Tell us what it's called and give us a bit of context.
It's called Hands Down, which is a racing term, means easy. The jockey won it hands down. He didn't need to raise his hands. And Sid Halley is back. I mean, Sid Halley was in the first book I wrote, and this is the third time I've used him in 16. And I mean, Sid has the advantage that he doesn't age as quickly as the rest of us, because he first appeared in 1965, and he was in his 30s then, and he's now not quite 50, and we're 60 years later. But he's having a problem in his life. His wife, Marina, has decided she needs some time out of their marriage to think about the future, and Sid is devastated. But then a friend, Gary Bremner, ex-jockey who's now a trainer, calls him to ask for his help. He's being threatened. Sid says, "Sorry, I can't help you. I've got my own problems at the moment." And the next morning, the news is that Gary's yard has been torched, horses have been killed, and Gary himself is missing. And Sid feels obligated to try and find out.
Okay, don't give anything else away.
That's the very beginning.
Yeah. Now, Sid is a private detective, isn't he?
Sid Halley is a very reluctant private detective. He was a private detective, but he's now given it up. And he's given it up mainly because his wife doesn't like it. And now his wife has gone off back to Holland. He does one last... Well, maybe it's not last. Sid lost his hand in the very first book. And for the next... four books, he had a myoelectric prosthesis. In this book, he's had a hand transplant. And a lot of the book is about the relationship he has with his hand and the relationship his wife has with the hand. I mean, in fact, my publisher called it a three-way love story between Sid, his wife, and his new hand, with a murder mystery laid on top of it. Anyway, one of the differences between my books and yours, Andrew, is that I write them all in the first-person narrative. So you can't see what anyone else has seen, but on the other hand, you can put in what the character is thinking. "Right, put him in cell 7, the custody sergeant said to my escort. "Hold on a minute," I complained. "Don't I have the right to make a phone call?" "No, you don't," said the sergeant. "But you do have the right to have one person informed you are here." I asked him to inform Admiral Rowland and gave him Charles's number. The sergeant dialed it straight away on the phone on his desk. "And please tell him that I won't be coming back tonight to collect my dog. And that if my wife calls him, just to tell her that I've lost my phone." The custody sergeant raised his eyebrows a tad at that last comment. But he passed the message on to Charles nevertheless. Then he listened for a moment. "The Admiral has asked whether you want him to organise a solicitor." I didn't really believe I needed a solicitor, because I hadn't done anything wrong. But so far, nothing else had quite panned out as I expected. Better to have and not need, I thought, than to need and not have, just like those pesky nuclear weapons. "That will be great," I said, and that message was also passed on as well. "Right," said the sergeant, putting down his phone. "Cell 7. "Where are the others?" I asked. "Never you mind." And so I had been marched off unceremoniously down the corridor to cell number 7, thrust inside, and then the cell door had been slammed shut behind me with a great metallic clang. It was no wonder that Chico had referred to prison as the slammer. If the noise was designed to intimidate the inmate, it was working.
Mm. It feels like we're in a bit of a prison cell here, sitting here together, cut off from the world.
Not me.
I love that though, Felix. I love the first person, because you just get that much more intimate connection with the hero, don't you?
When it asked, did I copy my father's style, I did insofar that he always wrote in the first person. Therefore, there was no question that I would do so, especially as I was writing a Dick Francis novel. But it has advantages and disadvantages. The advantages are that you get inside the head of your character and everything is seen through his eyes. And the reader is looking at the story through the eyes of your protagonist. The disadvantages is that it has to be a continuous timeline and you can't say, meanwhile, over in Wyoming, this and that was happening, because if your character isn't there, you can't see it. And I've done a few workshops of and given people an outline of a story and asked them to write it in the third person and in the first person. I mean, some people just change I to he all the way through, but it gives you different things to do. I mean, I love being able to put emotion into the book and my main character's emotion. I mean, I've said often that when I write it, sometimes what I write makes me cry. If it doesn't make me cry, how am I going to make the reader cry? And a lot of that comes from your character. The dog got mentioned in that piece I read. There's a lovely bit where Sid says to himself, why can't people be more like dogs? Dog doesn't mind when you get in late. Dog doesn't mind that you've been talking to other dogs. He uses the dog analogy with reference to what's happening in his marriage. Mm. You wouldn't expect your macho private detective or Jack Reacher to be able to have that conversation in order to put it in if it wasn't done through the first-person narrative.
Is it harder to maintain distance between you and the character when you're writing in the first person?
I don't think I do maintain distance between myself and the character.
Oh, okay.
The character behaves as I would behave. Sometimes I have to force myself to make the character behave in a different way. But all the characters in the book, apart from Sid Halley, who's been in six, and I wrote Jeff Hinckley in three, the others have all been standalones with different characters. But the thing they have in common is that they are all me. Does that make sense? I mean, they're not necessarily exactly me. They're all variations of me. But they, I mean, I once had fun by making one of the characters a female character, but without telling anybody. So you didn't know that until you got to the end of chapter two, because the character's name was Dr. Chris Rankin, and he was referred to as Doctor or Chris. And only at the end of chapter two, when Chris Rankin is thinking about the last visit she'd made to her gynecologist, did people sort of sit up and note and take note. But I want to ask Andrew a question, which I am looking forward to being able to ask you. And that is, Jack Reacher is a very large character. I don't just mean in characteristics, but in physical size. I mean, you and Lee are both very tall men. So you made Jack Reacher in your image, in my view. I mean, he was, 6'4"? What? How did Lee and how did you feel when you heard that Tom Cruise had been selected? Because I had friends who were obsessed with Jack Reacher and they were really not very happy about it. Yeah. I always said if Tom Cruise came along to play Sid Halley, I wouldn't care what size he was.
Well, you know, it was a very strange, I'd like to say few years, but really it went on for many, many years. And it, you know, it's partly a product of the times because, you know, as you probably know it right now, Reacher's on TV. That he's on streaming TV with Amazon.
With Alan Ritchson.
Yeah, Alan Ritchson.
He's a lot bigger.
And the thing is that had streaming television been a thing back when Lee started writing, he never would even have considered making a feature film. Because, you know, when you've got 8 hours to tell your story as opposed to 90 minutes, you're always going to choose that, particularly for Reacher, where, you know, a lot of Reacher fans will say that what they like is thinking along with Reacher. You know, they'll be presented with this conundrum. It'll seem impossible to figure out. Then step by step, deduction by deduction, Reacher solves the puzzle, and they love following along. And you can't do that in a 90-minute movie. So I personally think part of the problem with the movies was that they almost wound up with a slightly cartoonish element because Reacher came to the conclusions too quickly. It would be like he was in this room, something was hidden, and he'd say, oh, it must be under that notebook, you know, because there isn't time for him to go through the many, many, many steps of deduction. So that was an issue. But the thing was, when the movie rights were sold years ago before streaming television, and it was the company that Tom Cruise owns that bought them, at that point, of course, it's not certain that Tom himself would want to play Reacher. It could just be that he liked the franchise and he wanted to do the movies. And the thing was that he actually really did like the books. You know, Tom Cruise actually really did. And he's, you know, a really dedicated storyteller. He's a really good actor. And he was absolutely passionate and committed to doing those two movies that he did. And I think that he, if you forget about the size, if you take size out of the equation, Tom Cruise really did get a lot of the character, you know. There's a scene in the first movie where Reacher is sitting on his own in a diner wanting to have his food. And a woman comes up and starts provoking him, which is just a method to get him outside so the local hoodlums can beat him up or try. And Tom Cruise totally, without saying a word, captured that world-weary attitude that Reacher has, which is just leave me alone. I'm not looking for trouble. But if you start it, I'm sure as hell going to finish it. And Tom Cruise got that really, really well. But the thing was, you couldn't get away from the fact that part of Reacher is that if he walked into the room, like imagine Alan Ritchson walks into the room now, the hairs are going to go up on the back of your neck because you're going to think, oh my God, a giant has come in. What's he going to do? Am I in trouble? You know? And you put that into a bar or you put that into any environment. And that was really hard to convey, you know? And I think that that side of it, in the end, there was no getting away from. And I think, honestly, Lee hadn't, you know, he is about books, first, second, and third. You know, his whole life has been about books. And so when the idea of making the character into a movie came along, he thought of it as something separate. He didn't think of it being something that would in any way impact the books. And I remember being at events with him where people would say, what's Tom Cruise done to the books? And he'd say, well, nothing. I mean, do you think he's going to like break into your house and, you know, go to your bookcase and start tearing pages out of the book? He's not done anything to the books. If you don't like Tom Cruise, then don't see the movie. But it was impossible to separate them in the end. And that was something that he'd possibly underestimated. And so when it was then time to take a second look at how they were being dramatized and the opportunity to move to streaming television came along. You know, you'll never hear my brother say a bad word about Tom Cruise. They got on really well, and Tom was a great guy, and he behaved super professionally, and he was so respectful of the character and how to tell his stories. It was purely the physicality that there was no way around. So when it was time to move to TV, Tom doesn't do TV. He is a film actor exclusively. And so that was really kind of an elegant breakpoint. And so this time around, Lee kind of learnt from the experience, and he was much more involved in things like the casting. And so, you know.
Yes, I've learnt from that too, because, I mean, we have got our first draft script for a series based on the Dick and Felix Francis books as well. We hope. I mean, working title is The Turf, and with luck, by this time next year, as Del Boy used to say, we'll be filming, and not necessarily Millionaires, but and that is also a not a film. It is a TV series. We haven't yet got a broadcaster, but even though one broadcaster has paid for the script, that doesn't mean that they will take it. It's just gives them the first choice. So we'll wait and see. I'll believe it when I see it on the screen. I mean, there have been both film and television adaptations of Dick Francis in the past.
Let's wait and see.
Dare I say, you know, we all think they're never as good as the book.
Yeah.
I remember asking Anthony Horowitz this question, which is, how many people have you killed?
Goodness, lots. I'd have to. I honestly don't know. I don't keep a running total, but it's going to be, you know, got to be close to 100 at least.
Well, in my case, a lot less. There's normally, there's one, maybe two, sometimes none. There was one book I wrote had no one murdered, no one killed in it at all. But I did have a professional killer in one, a book called Crossfire. My main character was a soldier. And in fact, it starts in Afghanistan, where he loses his foot. The character was based around...
There's a lot of this in your books, people losing hands, yeah, feet, extremities.
Extremities, yes, you're quite right. My son was a soldier, and he was in Afghanistan. Fortunately, my son didn't lose a leg, but he knew people that had. And my character has lost his leg, and he's been not only in the army, he's been married to the army all his adult life, and suddenly the army are not really interested in him continuing. And he is the trained killer. And there are occasions in the book where people are killed, but my trained killer is able to not kill when the time arises. So it's not always murder mysteries. Mm. They're not all murders. They're all mysteries. But there's not always a murder, but there often is a murder. And my character, certainly Sid Halley, is always getting close to being murdered himself. So,
well, when I asked Anthony Horowitz that question, he responded with a question, which was, in fiction or in real life? And the answer was not zero in either category.
Well, I don't think I electrocuted any of my pupils when I was a physics teacher. nearly electrocuted myself once, but...
Trespassers in Wyoming?
Well, no problems in Wyoming. My previous career, though, it was covered by the Official Secrets Act, so those kind of questions we have to steer clear of.
And what was it that you were doing?
Well, it was covered by the Official Secrets Act, so...
Oh dear, I'm glad you're here, Felix.
Well, I had to sign the Official Secrets Act as well, because I was a reserve officer in the RAF for 20 years, so... But I,
or so you say.
But I never killed anyone. There's no one I knew of. but I did fly around in fast jets for a while, but never had to push any buttons.
So all the antics that Jack Reacher gets up to are probably quite vanilla compared to what you're personally used to.
Well, you know, the antics are really one of the fun parts of the book. So we base them on imagination, on past life experiences, on stuff that we've read about, people we've met and talked to. So, you know, there's a lot of material.
So the truth is, you have no imagination at all. It's all just based on things that have happened to you.
Well, you know, did you ever watch the original House of Cards? Because there was a great line in that. You may think that, but I couldn't possibly comment.
I couldn't possibly comment. Yes, Francis Urquhart.
Urquhart, yeah.
Known as.
Okay, I want to play you. So I've been talking about Raj Mohan Gandhi and interested in him because he's also part of a dynasty, obviously a well-known name. I was at the Kushwant Singh Literary Festival in Kasauli in northern India, in Himachal Pradesh, up about 6,500 feet, which is low in the Himalayas. He was there talking about various things, and I asked Raj Mohan Gandhi about the idea of having the influence of this famous name.
I'm Raj Mohan Gandhi. I've been teaching in the United States. I've been writing books on history, and I've been attending this amazing literary festival here.
What is it about history that grabs you, that fascinates you?
Well, I think I went to history because I wanted to see why there was so much pain and unhappiness around me. I wanted to understand the roots of it. And once I began studying and finding out some information, some insight, I was just grabbed by it. And I felt that people were so interesting and trends in history were so interesting that studying them became quite a fascination for me.
Was there a particular event that first got you?
Yes, of course. I think the independence of India in 1947 was accompanied by this terrible violence, carnage, people, historians give different figures. Some people say 1 million were killed. Some people say 2 million were killed. My own researches and the consensus among most historians is that about between 500,000 and 1 million were killed, mostly in the Punjab province, in undivided Punjab, now in partly in Pakistan, partly in India. I was 12 when all this happened. And shortly thereafter, within a few months after that, my grandfather was assassinated, Gandhi, for wanting equality and between Hindus and Muslims and rights for that India belonged to Muslims as much as to Hindus. Some people didn't like that, and so he was killed. So those events of 47 and then my grandfather's killing in January 48 certainly were among these important factors.
Now, I'm also talking to some other writers who are carrying on a famous name. Lee Child, you may know of. And he is now writing with his brother, Andrew. Andrew Grant, but who'll now be known as Andrew Child. And they also have a Belfast link because their father was from Belfast. So we're talking to him. Also, perhaps you know of Dick Francis, the writer.
Yes, yes.
So his son, Felix, is carrying on the brand. Do you have any insights about being a writer in the same line as a very famous family member, i.e. your grandfather, Mahatma Gandhi? So you too have carved out a career as a historian and influential opinion former. Are there any benefits, disadvantages, pros and cons that you've encountered?
So, yes, I'll say this, that at an early-ish stage, I must have been in my early 20s, I did make a decision that I would try and figure out my life or my steps I should take, not by asking myself what my grandfather might have wanted me to do, but what I felt was right. But satisfaction of my conscience rather than obedience to his views was my conscious decision. This does not mean that being his grandson didn't influence me in this way or that way. I am not capable enough to knowing all of myself and of my inner motivations. But my conscious effort was certainly to distance myself from Gandhi in the sense of that his life was his life, my life is my life. At the same time, my own inclinations are very much in alignment with his views about equality and liberty and forgiveness and fighting, but also not hating the adversary.
What about writing style?
Yes, I this is the other interesting thing about Gandhi. Here I am as a student of Gandhi's life. He never went to a university, although he did study law in London. He only went to high school in India. Where he found the ability to become such a good writer as he became in English and also in Gujarati, he was quite a gifted writer in that, is a mystery to me. He wrote concisely, briefly. He never used bombastic language. So the strength of his writing came out in its logic, not in its...
And how does that compare to you? I'm not suggesting you're bombastic. Have you ever felt that you were writing in a similar style or felt that you could learn from his style? Or did you ever think, I will try and write differently?
No. Because other writers influenced me much earlier than Gandhi's writings influenced me.
Like who?
Well, one of the books that greatly impressed me in my early or mid-teens was Alan Paton's Cry the Beloved Country.
Yes. I remember studying that.
But, I shed tears over the pages of that book. So then I have other, this writer who wrote this famous book, World War II book, who then wrote about all kinds of other things. What was that book called?
Paul Gallico, The Snow Goose.
Snow Goose.
So Paul Gallico, The Snow Goose.
I absolutely was bowled over. Then I discovered that he wrote these other kinds of books, the Mrs. Harris books. I said, I want to write a biography of Paul Gallico. That's one of my many unfulfilled projects.
Rajmohan Gandhi, thank you very much.
Thank you, friend.
I think that brings us to the end of part 3 of this episode of We'd Like a Word. With me, Paul Waters.
And me, Stephen Colgan.
See you in the special bonus part 4 of this episode in just a minute.